This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 301 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'd like to introduce the co-hosts. First, we have David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. Hello, listeners. I'm not going to talk about the weather, but I really do. I really cannot get used to recording in the summers and it still be daylight when we do this. It's supposed to be dark.
It is supposed to be dark. It feels more natural when it's dark. Well, our other co-host, Rob Mark, you're not someplace dark, are you, right now?
Well, not really. I'm someplace noisy. Coming back from vacation in the Caribbean, and I'm changing planes at Miami International. And boy, was that fun coming through international customs and all the other good stuff. But we could talk about that another time.
Yeah, we'll have to talk about who you're flying on and how good a job they did.
True.
And clearly they didn't eat the fish because I don't hear you bragging that you've brought the airplane down.
No, and on top of it, it always happens to me, but when they put me on one of these airplanes, I'm in row 25. So you know there are going to be 30 guys ahead of me that know how to fly in case they ever needed somebody. So I'll never get that chance.
Okay. That may be a good thing.
Well, if worse comes to worse, I'm assuming Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is up there somewhere, right?
Yeah.
Good point.
Just in case.
Yeah.
Well, that's the voice of our guest. He's Ron Rapp. Now, Ron is a professional charter pilot. He's got over 7,000 hours. Now, Ron has flown, I don't know, more aircraft than just about anybody, I guess. He's flown tailwheel, aerobatics, formation flying, gliders, seaplanes, turboprops, biz jets, warbirds, experimentals, radials. It just, the list goes on and on. Ron's also volunteered with Angel Flight, and he's even written messages in the air as a sky typer. We'll talk about that coming up. He's done some crop dusting, flown across oceans in a Gulf Stream 4. Ron's also done some writing. He writes for AOPA's Opinion Leaders blog. His works appeared in Sport Aviation and Sport Aerobatics, Airscape, and some others. And, oh, yes, and Ron writes a blog at House of Rapp. So, Ron, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Well, thanks, Max. I'm really delighted to be here. And I'd like to start by saying congratulations on your 300th episode, because I think that's a huge, huge achievement.
Oh, thank you. We really appreciate it. That's very nice. We heard from quite a few listeners offering their congratulations on us achieving 300 episodes, and we appreciate all of those comments. Ron, what kind of aircraft have you actually owned yourself? You've flown in all those different kinds of things, but what have you owned?
I've owned three different aircraft. The first one was a partnership in a 1963 Cherokee 180. Great airplane to start out with.
Yeah.
You know, it was one of the first ones ever built, actually, a very low serial number. And it was very inexpensive. I mean, it was, I don't know, it was in the late 90s, but I kind of feel like it's the sort of thing you'll never see again. I think I paid maybe $7,000 to buy into that airplane.
Hmm.
I mean, now it's, you know, I flight instruct still, and I've seen people with, they'll go on a flight with me in a Cirrus or something, or a Twin Star, and, you know, the bill is in the four figures just from one flight. And for $7,000, I bought a share of an entire airplane.
Wow.
So, yeah, I really liked that one, too, because it was one of those planes where you could fill the tanks, fill the seats, you know, 180 horsepower, and it could just go. And then the next plane I owned, the only one I've owned on my own, actually, was a 1975 Skyline.
Mm.
And fantastic. The first time I went for a test flight, that Continental 0470 was just so smooth that I fell in love with it.
Fantastic.
Flew it maybe, 800 hours I put on it. Never had a canceled flight. Never had to scrub it for any reason. It just was the most reliable thing I've ever flown. And then the third one is a 1993 Pitts S2B, again, a partnership. And those airplanes, you kind of beat the heck out of them, you know, because they're aerobatic. So it's kind of nice to have a partnership, because that way, when the big bills come due, you can at least split it with some people.
Rob, have you ever bought any aircraft on a sort of partnership basis? Or are you mostly flying club aircraft?
Partnerships? No, I've had aircraft that I owned that I rented. No, I did have a partnership. I'm sorry. I had a partnership in a Blanka Viking a long, long time ago. But it was pretty simple. We just split everything, and it all worked fine.
All right. Well, we have a bunch of topics we're going to talk about with Ron. But first, we're going to start with some current aviation news. We're going to talk about the feds easing off on general aviation intercepts. We're going to talk about a C-Series test aircraft that experienced an apparent GTF engine failure. Also, the Airbus CEO comments on the A320neo entry into service. And also, the FAA wants to establish a center of excellence for unmanned aircraft systems.
Isn't that a little redundant?
Well, we'll find out, Rob.
No, that wouldn't be redundant. That would be an oxymoron, I guess, wouldn't it?
Okay. All right. David, what do we have coming up for the history segment?
Well, this week is the 70th anniversary of Operation Overlord, otherwise known as D-Day, the invasion of France. So I thought we'd do a little spin and talk about Spitfires, which seems pretty obvious for D-Day, but these were Spitfires flown by U.S. Navy aviators, 17 of them. So we're going to talk about VCS-7.
All right. We also have an aviation minute from Rob. Rob, you're talking about veterans and aviation this week, I believe?
Well, I am, actually. And even though we had Veterans Day a couple of days ago here, in the official Veterans Day here in the States, I thought there were some interesting thoughts about it that needed commenting on. So that's what we're going to chat about tonight.
Great. And Peter Johnson, in his Across the Pond segment, responds to some listener feedback. And he asks Osama Salah to give us an update on the state of the airlines in North Africa. And then we have some listener feedback. And if we get to all of it, we'll talk about, well, we'll listen to a short recording from Marcus at the Omega Tau podcast on his first airshow experience. Something about morphing wings from Jamie. That I almost died in a plane crash article that probably many of you all have read by now, seen by now. Also, a job opening for an A&P mechanic from Jody. Juan has a belly camera video from a Sukhoi Superjet 100. A little Honda Jet update from Robbie. And then finally, maybe, some dog poo forces an emergency landing. And Rob sent that to us. Not our Rob, but a different Rob. So this wasn't Simba the Wonder Dog, but
no, my dog
else
would never do anything like that.
Yeah, I hope.
You can call that the he stepped in it segment, right?
That's exactly right. All right. Hopefully we'll get all that in, but we'll see. So why don't we go ahead and get started? Is everyone ready?
Ready.
Let's do it.
Ready.
Our first item was sent in by listener Jamie Dodson. This comes from NPR, which for those of you who may not know, that's National Public Radio in the U.S. And this is titled, After Private Pilots Complain, Customs Rethinks Intercept Policy. The background is armed U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents have been approaching general aviation airplanes to detain and question pilots. So the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association and others have protested vigorously, but with little response from the feds as to why and under what authority this has been taking place. So NPR reports that the CBP has told them that this is going to change and that law-abiding pilots won't be so needlessly detained for warrantless searches. This has been a big issue certainly in the general aviation community, Rob. I think with good reason.
Well, it's kind of like the tanker story from years ago that would never go away. This just doesn't seem to want to stop, and no one is really sure why these people are being detained. There's been a lot of speculation that they're customs people think they're carrying drugs and a few other things, but there's absolutely no evidence, and they seem to pick on the most honest-looking citizens you ever saw. And of course, I think we talked about this a few months ago, that the best example of this was when they pulled John and Martha King over, right. And there's that famous picture of Martha King hopping out of their 172 with her hands up, and they've got six guns trained on her. I mean, and it's just incredible.
Well, can you blame him? I mean, isn't she the most threatening looking person ever? Come on.
Oh, absolutely. She has hair like me. I mean, that's a nice comment, Martha, in case you're listening. But
the woman can fly, is licensed to fly a blimp. That could be dangerous.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. And the trouble is, we don't really know what brought all this on. This just started, what, maybe a year, maybe 2 years ago?
Yeah, it feels
and
like.
And it just keeps going on. And even Congress hasn't been able to get to the bottom of it. So, well, I guess that's another one of those oxymorons, isn't it? Congress accomplishing something? Well, anyway.
I think another part of the problem with this, too, is any time that they do get word one out of the Customs and Border Patrol, it's always something that makes absolutely no sense. Like, I was reading an article where one of the couples or people that was stopped, you know, they said that they were stopped because their profile was suspicious. So they asked, well, what was suspicious about it? And they said, you were flying east from California.
almost everything is east from California.
Yeah, I would think that would be the most normal thing ever. I mean, how many planes fly east from California in a given day? There's got to be thousands.
Well, the article mentions that according to the FAA, there's more than 7 million personal, instructional, or business flights every year of about 2 hours. And apparently, Customs and Border Patrol operates this tracking center in Riverside, California, and they watch some of these flights. And I don't know, it seems like they have some kind of algorithm or some kind of logic that as they're watching flights, you know, where they go, where they come from, how long they're flying, whatever, and it trips some kind of alert. But apparently it's been tripping this alert for a lot of people that, you know, for which there's no reason to suspect any illegal activity or drug running or something like that. And I got to believe this is, you know, a really harrowing experience. I mean, these you're at the airport or the airstrip, whatever, and all of a sudden, you know, the feds arrive, they're armed, police arrive. It's sort of a hostile situation. So I hope that a little bit more sanity will prevail, and we won't see quite so much of this sort of thing.
I'm kind of curious what you guys think of, because you've been following this so closely, what you think the root cause of their rethinking the intercept policy is. I mean, was it complaints from private pilots? Was it AOPA? Was it the fact that the GA caucus in Congress is growing so rapidly? You know, what's changed their mind? I mean, most of the time the government seems to just sort of cast aside.
Yeah, do what it wants to do.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's hard to tell, but I think maybe all of those things played a role. They're kind of intimating that, you know, we've listened to the pilots, and so we're responding to that. But, you know, that may or may not be the actual motivation underlying this change, if in fact we're going to see a real meaningful change.
Well, no, because we really don't even know what the motivation was to start in the first place. So they could have just said, hey, you know what? Oh, the calendar's changed years now. We don't have to do this so much anymore. We just don't have any idea at all. And that's what's really the most frustrating. And again, it's not like they're catching bad guys.
They claim to have found a couple of folks doing something improper. But, you know, out of those 7 million flights, that's a really small number. All right, well, let's push on to our next item. This comes from ATW Online. C-Series flight testing halted after GTF engine failure. Well, the geared turbofan engine on a Bombardier C-Series, their test aircraft, FTV-1, experienced an engine failure. Now, this was during stationary maintenance testing. So the C-Series aircraft was on the ground. Both engines were running. It was, well, maybe not literally bolted down, but figuratively for some kind of maintenance testing. And one of the engines let go, reportedly damaging the engine nacelle and the fuselage. No apparent damage to the wing. So Bombardier has suspended flight testing. Their ground testing continues, as we understand it, and the engine has gone to Pratt & Whitney for disassembly. So this is, you know, every program seems to have some kind of event in it that sort of slows things up and, you know, causes some problems. And the C-Series has experienced kind of a big one here, it looks like.
Yeah, but this is kind of late in the testing period to have this kind of a failure, isn't it?
Yeah, because the engines have been run for quite a large number of hours to this point. This whole thing reminds me of when there's an aviation accident where, you know, you get the initial reports in the press and it's got, you know, some information but not much. And as each day goes by, you kind of get a little bit more information and, you know, things start to become clear. And that's happening here. We see some articles from Reuters, for example, where the John Leahy, the Airbus sales chief, has told a group of journalists that it shouldn't affect us in the slightest. This is a different engine. Of course, he's referring to the A320neo, which uses a larger version of the geared turbofan engine. Bombardier is saying that they don't think that this is going to impact the entry into service, that they've got buffer built in. And they don't, at least at this point, foresee that buffer being consumed completely by this event.
But it really depends on what it is that caused the failure.
Exactly. I mean, yeah.
And I would think that the people at Pratt & Whitney are probably more worried about this than the Bombardier people are.
Yeah, you know they're all over it. The engine was sent to Pratt & Whitney this past weekend, I understand, or I read in the press. And for disassembly and inspection, John Ostrower wrote in the Wall Street Journal that a person, quote, familiar with the probe. So here's the unnamed party says Pratt, quote, has a good grasp on what the issue is, and also that the problem could be addressed fairly rapidly if its initial assessment proves correct. So yeah, we don't know. I mean, maybe somebody. I mean, not literally, but, you know, plugged something in the wrong place or forgot to put oil in the engine or, you know, whatever, something that's kind of a one-off event. Or it could end up being a design issue that's going to create a lot more drama if it goes that way. But we don't know at this point.
One of the things that caught my eye about one of the articles I read on this engine failure is that it damaged not only the engine but also the fuselage. And yeah. As I understand it, the purpose of the engine cowling is to contain any failure in the engine so that it doesn't impact the fuselage. So I'm kind of wondering, I mean, we don't know anything. I'm just kind of thinking, you know, were the cowlings open during this run or something? I can't imagine they would be, but...
Yeah, because an uncontained engine failure, you know, for us engine guys, that's pretty much the worst case scenario. An engine failure in and of itself is bad, but one in which, you know, metal exits the engine... is very considered very serious, but like you say, Ron, we kind of don't know the situation or the circumstances at this point.
Well, and again, this late in the process is the big concern. I would think they'd be talking about too. Now, Max, you're the engine dude. I mean, is this essentially the same core? I mean, just a different size core and whatever that's going to be on the Neo.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's the Neo core is larger. It's got about, I think, about twice the thrust of the C-Series engine. So it's, but it's very similar. One thing I did see, and this might have been from Madison Schoenland, I probably shouldn't quote him if I'm not certain, but one of the sources said that it was not an issue with the gear. Of course, that would be everybody's first question, you know, because that's the sort of the heart of the new engine is the gear causing a problem. And at least this one report if I can find it, I'll put it in the show notes, said that it was not an issue with the gear.
I'll inject here that for us people who really didn't know what a geared turbofan is, there's a lovely detailed article in this month's Air and Space magazine about geared turbofans and how they work with a wonderful cutaway. So I finally get a concept of what a geared turbofan is. I'll go back to preferring turbojets. But
it's a very simple concept when you really get down to it. But yeah,
it is. But we've been talking about it for that. It's a new revolution in engines. And I recommend the current copy of Air and Space because you could learn about GTFs and how to build your own drone. So, Max, it's definitely they wrote a magazine for you.
All right. We'll have to get that. All right, next item came from David Abbey. We mentioned the A320neo. This comes from MarketWatch, from the Airbus CEO. The A320 intro must be flawless. And this actually came out a few days prior to the C-Series incident with the engine. This was at the annual shareholders meeting in Amsterdam, where Airbus CEO Tom Enders said that the A320neo introduction needs to be perfect so the company can meet its profitability and cash flow targets. So this is coming up pretty quick. First flight is scheduled for September of this year with deliveries starting in 2015. And of course, the A320 series, that's the volume business for Airbus, just like the 737 is the volume business for Boeing. So with this re-engining, they really need to get it right the first time, which is the point.
But you know what's interesting? I've never heard a company sort of admit that in public, that because to me, and maybe it.
Oh, we lost Rob.
Uh oh.
All right. Well, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say it. Yeah, it is unusual, as Rob was commenting, rather, that for a company to admit that they really need that. I mean, that's putting a lot of pressure on themselves.
Yeah,
it kind of reminds me of like Pat Riley guaranteeing the Lakers. I'm in LA, so you know I'm going to say this, but it's like Pat Riley guaranteeing the Lakers are going to have a repeat back in the 80s. It's just, it's really laying the ball out there and just kind of pointing out to the left field. So,
or the Clippers are going to get sold.
That's like shooting fish in a barrel at this point.
But oh dear.
I think that what I'm guessing is maybe they're very confident that it is going to be a real flawless entry. And so they can say this, and then they'll end up meeting these quote-unquote high expectations.
Yeah, and there's certainly a lot of, as we've mentioned, a lot of activity going on, a lot of new products coming out, the A320neo, the 737 MAX. Airbus is working on the A350, and they see some challenges there. And Boeing, of course, has just done the 787 Dreamliner, and you know these are big bet-your-company kinds of strategies. And they really do need to try to get it right the first time because to do otherwise, well, I mean, not only is it just expensive, but it can have a potentially damaging effect in the marketplace.
And we haven't seen a clean entry into service for any of these airlines, not to mention the F-35, since we've been doing the show.
Yeah, that's a good point. So there's a lot of stress in the industry, in the commercial aviation industry, to perform and to perform well. Well, let's move on. We've lost Rob. He's, as we said before, he's in an airport, and the local Wi-Fi might be a little bit dodgy. Hopefully, we'll get Rob back. Meantime, last news item comes from the FAA, a press release. FAA to establish UAS Center of Excellence. We really need Rob back for this one because he's such a unmanned fan. The FAA wants to create a center of excellence to support their research program for unmanned aircraft systems, UAS. That's what the FAA calls drones or UAVs or what have you. And they've released a draft solicitation that will be open for comment through June 29th, with a final solicitation to be published in August. David, maybe you could just mention a little bit about what this center of excellence is all about.
Well, we have seven test centers that the FAA has approved that are been ramping up over the last couple of months. We're up to two that are officially up and running. The other five are. But the FAA wants some sort of center now to incorporate all of those data points into an area where they can set standards and basically promote UAVs into the civil airspace. But this, I have a feeling, will happen as quick as our small UAV guidelines. But they do want a consolidated area and a team to absorb all the data so that, and they can disseminate it back out to the teams. One of the things we've talked about on UAV Digest is when they set up these seven sites, how are they going to communicate together? And, you know, they're all tasked with different challenges, but they all could benefit from each other's learning curves. So this is going to be a cooperative agreement with each COE and core member university, and they're going to submit proposals so that one of these places will homogenize all of the data.
Ron, do you have the same kind of fear that maybe Rob has when it comes to fleets of little UAVs flying around in the skies in the airspace?
I absolutely do. In fact, I don't know where you draw the line between a UAV and a remote-controlled aircraft. It's six of one, half a dozen of the other, but I've actually come across remote-controlled aircraft, I mean big ones, in flight. I was actually in the pattern at the Chino Airport with a student. We were on a left downwind for runway 26 left, I think. Anyway, we were instructed to make a right 360, so we do that, and as we're in the right turn, I think we were in a twin star or something, I see something shoot up out of the corner of my eye, and I have to look up through the bubble canopy, and I see there's maybe a 1/5 scale or whatever extra 300 going straight up. Yeah, I mean, if it had hit us, it was a big sucker, and it was really moving, too. So I can only imagine, I'm sure they can be integrated successfully, but you're going to have a lot of people like delivering beer and laundry and things like that, and I don't necessarily see them being on the same level as a charter airline or,
right.
You know what I mean? That's really my concern. Plus, yeah, these things are so cheap, so light, so easily accessible that I have a feeling there's going to be a ton of them out there.
And now that
I'm back, sure, now he shows up.
Yeah, I think my Miami credit card died or something. I don't know what it was, but Ron, and that's exactly the kinds of things that I've been talking about for ages, and I'm sure they will be successfully added into the airspace somehow someday. But the FAA is probably the least capable organization, I think, of bearing up under the pressure of lobbyists and that sort of thing to make something happen. And they're under a lot of pressure right now to get in there and make it all come together. I saw a story, and maybe you guys mentioned this when I dropped out of sight, but they are talking about trying to make exceptions for UAVs that will be used in the filming industry, movie industry, and seeing they're already saying, well, except for this, we can do that. Well, maybe we can do that one, but no more. Right? But then there's this one too. We could probably get away with that one. And all I care about is the fact that they don't have the technology in place for how we're not going to get whacked out of the sky with one of these things. I mean, I wouldn't care if someone could prove to me that was in place, but I have not seen that at all.
Yeah, and it doesn't exist really at this point.
No, it doesn't. And everybody just keeps saying, well, we've got to get this going. We've got to get this going. Except for the safety part, it's all going to work. Well, that to me, that is the part. That's the part I really care about, because that's what's going to kill somebody.
I actually saw a comparison between the FAA's regulation of unmanned aerial vehicles and the FCC's loss of control of the frequency spread for the CB radios. If enough people jump in and they just start using it, eventually there's not going to be anything the FAA can do. I mean, when there's a million of these things out there, how are they going to enforce that?
Right. And I think we may have already reached that point. Certainly the film industry is not waiting. And we see many examples of that, despite the prohibition on commercial use of UAVs, small UAVs.
Don't forget the real estate agent.
The real estate agent industry, yep, same thing. And the agriculture industry is also chomping on the bit because, they've got some great applications that'll help them. So,
And you know what? And none of these people are thinking about the safety of people on board 121, Part 121 airliners or 135 charter airplanes or corporate airplanes or anything else. I'm not saying they wouldn't care if they were made more aware of what the threat is, but I don't think most of them have a clue what's going on with that.
Again, we're speaking with Ron Rapp. He blogs at House of Rapp, which is at rapp.org. Rapp is R-A-P-P. Ron, did I read someplace that when you started that blog that you got a lot of email and attention by people that thought you were doing something with music?
Yes, you did. You did. And it's funny because that's actually what I studied in college. Music, theater, English literature. I have degrees in those things. So, you know, I don't know, maybe Google or Alta Vista or whatever the search engine was back at the time was picking up, rap and music and coming up with my website. But I would get some crazy messages. I still got them somewhere. I got to dig them out because it's hilarious. I mean, really broken English people wanting help with a budding career in rap music. You know, that's the one type of music I am not involved in. So
when I started the 30,000 Feet back in 1996, maybe, 30,000 Feet. I got a lot of email, a lot of attention from people who had a foot fetish, and they thought that this was some place where they could go to really satisfy their, their interests. But it wasn't to be. So tell us a little bit about the blog and the writing that you're doing. I know you've written recently about user fees for general aviation.
I have. Yeah, it's a big topic. And what I wrote about in that article actually was I was responding to a news article that discussed how the Obama administration is removing federal restrictions on states imposing tolls on the federal highway system. So they're free to turn the freeways into tollways. And it's basically just another user fee. But the general gist of my article was, for every airplane pilot, there's 1,000, maybe 2,000 drivers on the road. And if they can't stop user fees from encroaching on the highways, I don't know how we're going to stop them or even justify stopping them in aviation. So I think we need to focus on eliminating transportation user fees in general. And if we need to make adjustments in, for example, the fuel taxes in either GA or for the roadways, then I know those are politically unpopular, but it's a lot better than tollways every, few miles on the interstate.
Sure.
But as far as the writing goes, because my website is so old, it's one of the oldest substantial personal websites on the internet, on the web, rather. I started writing about theater, music, things I was doing at that time. And then in the mid to late 90s, when I started flying, my writing started to reflect more of a focus on aviation. Places I would go, things I would do. And then I started, of course, teaching and, flying commercially for a living. And I did a lot of weird things. Not weird, but I mean just a wide variety of things, whether it's high performance aerobatics or competition formation flying. You mentioned the Sky Typers thing, which is a formation skywriting. I did some flying with them.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit since you mentioned it. I wanted to I had been aware of Sky Typers actually for a number of years now, and so I know what it is. But maybe describe it for our listeners, just what that means, sky typing.
Well, sure. When a lot of people think of skywriting, they think of one airplane up in the sky drawing individual letters, and that does take place. But if you want to create a long message or a phrase or a website URL or something like that, one airplane's not going to be able to do it. By the time you get to the third letter, the first one's already been wiped away by the wind. So what skytyping does is use a series of 5 airplanes that fly in a line abreast formation, and the center airplane has 2 people in it. One's flying the airplane and the other one has a computer. He's connected via Wi-Fi to these other airplanes and controls the smoke system electronically. And it turns the smoke on and the appropriate times. And what it does is it creates a dot matrix-like message in the sky. So you can write 20-mile-long messages. I was just in, where was I? Oh, I was in Austin, actually on the Gulf Stream for the South by Southwest Festival. And someone out there had hired sky typers to go up and just print the number pi up there in the sky, like 1,000 digits of it,
Wow.
They get hired to do the craziest things. Sometimes it'll be the Super Bowl. Sometimes it'll be something like this. It can be wedding proposals for people on the beach. They can do simple graphics. It's a really great system. There's actually two teams, I believe. There's a West Coast team that I flew with. They're based out of Chino. And there's an East Coast team based, I believe, in New York. So it's a great system.
What does it take to become a pilot? I mean, do you have to have some kind of special certification or?
Well, you have to have a commercial pilot certificate because it's a commercial
sure.
activity.
Yeah.
And basically beyond that, what they're looking for is formation flying experience. And that's how I got in with them because they were really looking for people. I guess it's difficult to find folks who have that. So,
what kind of airplane are they using?
Well, the West Coast team uses the Grumman Tiger. And East Coast, I think they're using the T-6. Or no, I'm sorry. I think it's an SNJ-5.
They're actually SNJ-2s.
SNJ-2s. Okay, there you go. See, you are the history guy.
Well, it also pays when you've flown in the back seat of them.
There you go.
The Skytype, I actually was fortunate enough to fly with the Geico Skytypers.
Awesome.
But Max and Rob has subsequently forgot that.
No, I remember that. This whole thing is a setup, David, for you to to reinforce your flight with them.
Well, they like us, so
they're great people, and I wish I could fly with them more. Unfortunately, my job on the Gulfstream I need to stay available a lot and I have trips that kind of interfere and things like that. So I don't really fly with them a whole lot anymore. But
what model Gulfstream are you flying?
I'm flying the G4, and my type rating covers the 4, the 4SP, the 300, and the 400.
Yes. You probably saw that story about that awful accident this last weekend, huh?
I did. In fact, a lot of people came out of the woodwork, to ask if I was on it. It's funny to get a text message from people going, "Hey, are you dead?"
Yeah.
Yeah, and for people that may not know what we're talking about, a G4 SP crashed on takeoff on... was it Saturday, I think? Saturday afternoon over at Bedford at Hanscom Field. And,
actually, it wasn't evening. It was like 9:30 at night.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Philadelphia is reeling from it because one of the people and the owner of the airplane, Katz, actually owns all of the newspapers in town and is a huge donor to my university, Temple. It's had a lot of effect on a lot of people here in Philadelphia. In fact, interestingly, they interviewed our former governor, Ed Rendell, and he was supposed to go up on that flight and at the last minute was turned down due to other events. So wow. He's pretty devastated about the loss. So, yeah, it's been a tragedy here in Philadelphia more than your normal average run-of-the-mill accident.
Yeah,
we really don't have any facts at all about anything that happened except that the airplane never got airborne is about the only thing they seem to know.
But they did find the black box today.
That's good.
They found the flight data recorder in the black box.
All right. That's probably a topic then we'll be talking about in the future as more information becomes available. Ron, so I see that you have experience in more than 60 aircraft types. How do you do that? How do you come to have experience in so many different kinds of aircraft? I mean, it sounds like a great objective. Do you try to rack up as many as you can?
That was never really the goal, but in answer to your question, how do you fly that many? It's not really that many. I mean, I've met people who've flown, 100, 200, 300. I think, if you talk to guys like Clay Lacy or guys like that, they're astronomical numbers that they've flown. Basically the answer is, in my case, you meet a lot of people. And that's really kind of been the key to everything in my career in aviation is I've just gotten to know a lot of people. It helps that I do a lot of different types of things. If I wanted to, I could just be on the Gulfstream full time and that would be all I flew. But I really do enjoy, and I think it's helpful for my own personal skill as a pilot to go from a King Air to a Pitts to a Gulfstream to a glider. I feel like it maintains a level of skill in each area. So the Gulfstream obviously is IFR, all that kind of stuff. But you don't do a lot of hand flying. It's not that kind of airplane. So, I do other things that help maintain skills and my own personal interest in aviation in those areas. So, I've just met a lot of people. And I think part of it too is where I live, which is in the Orange County, California area. So Orange County has, maybe 4 million people, and it has two airports. So there's Fullerton, which is pretty far inland, and there's John Wayne. So if you live anywhere near the coast, Laguna Beach, Newport Beach, Huntington Beach, you know, any of these places, you're probably going to go to John Wayne. So I've met a lot of people who have a lot of cool airplanes, just old warbirds and helicopters, and you'll find aerobatic planes and obviously airliners out there. It's a really great airport to meet people and just see all sorts of different things. And over time, it just sort of bloomed and blossomed, and I'm kind of where I am.
And John Wayne has a great departure, sort of.
Oh, for the airliners?
Yeah. The noise abatement ballistic departure. The most interesting flight. I actually have family who lived in Laguna, so we used to fly to John Wayne. The most interesting flight I've ever taken was I took a flight on U.S. Airways on a 737. I think it was. Don't quote me because I'm sure Dan. I hear Dan Webb in my ears saying you're wrong. But I had a flight from John Wayne to LAX. Which basically was a ballistic trajectory. We blasted out of John Wayne, and then we were on within minutes talking to the tower at LAX for final approach. It was a very unique flight.
Yeah, I really enjoy John Wayne. It's a great airport, you know, and there's so much going on there. I mean, I've met people who have thousands of hours, and they'll be very uncomfortable flying at a place like John Wayne because they're just not used to that level of activity. And at this point, I pretty much take it for granted. I learned to fly there. But, yeah, you see all kinds of interesting things go on. But the people are very friendly. You know, you're right. You're very close to the beach. And it's a great place. I'm real happy to live in that area.
Well, see, and Chino is further inland, I guess, then, right?
Yeah. It's more toward the Riverside area.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. Boy, that just sounds like a neat place to be around airplanes, though.
It is. It definitely is. We're very lucky. You know, a lot of the aerospace industry has moved out of Southern California, but there's still a lot of stuff here, whether it's the Planes of Fame Museum at Chino or the Robinson Helicopter Factory out at Torrance or Santa Monica, which is one of my favorite airports. I mean, we've got Catalina, we've got all kinds of stuff. So there's still a lot going on, and there's a lot to say about aviation in Southern California. I mean, if nothing else, I write for this blogging information group, and one of the guys I write with, Brent Owens, iFlyBlog.com.
Oh, yes, we know Brent.
Yeah, you know Brent. In fact, I think he's been on the show, hasn't he?
Yes, he has.
Yeah. Well, he's in, I want to say Ohio somewhere, you know, and I'll be out flying or something in, I don't know, December or something, and he'll be like, yeah, I can't even get the hangar doors open because they're frozen shut or who knows what. So
Ron, is it contract flying that pays your bills primarily?
Primarily, yeah.
So tell us about contract flying and what that involves.
Well, sure. I got into contracting. Well, I started just because that's what was available at the time. And basically, I'm kind of like overflow labor. Actually, if people want to read more about this, I just wrote an article on my website about it, the contract pilot. It's like a couple of weeks ago I came out with it or something. But anyway, it's basically overflow labor. So, you know, you've got a charter company, let's say, and they need an additional pilot for some reason. Maybe someone gets sick or they resign or they have to go in for training or... You know, who knows what? I mean, God forbid they can't get their medical certificate. So, you know, sometimes you'll need three crew on a flight because of the length and duty day limitations or whatnot. So basically, I kind of fill in. And it keeps me on the road. The full-time guys on this kind of airplane are probably on the road about 3 weeks out of the month, which is a little bit much for me being married and all that. So
yeah, I think that'd be very tough.
It is. It can be very tough. You're in hotel rooms and, you know, I have a lot of respect for the guys who do that full-time flying. It can be very challenging. You're on one side of the globe on Monday and you're on the other side on Tuesday. You know, it can be tough. You can also have a week in Hawaii or in the Caribbean. I've done those trips too. So, it can be really wonderful. And so I fly about maybe 10 or 12 days a month on average. And, the nice thing is I get paid a lot more per day. I work fewer days and I'm home more, which makes my wife and me happy. And it leaves me around here to do other types of flying. So I do some instructional things. I teach aerobatics, or I do a lot of RV transition training. I'll ferry aircraft. I'll just go flying with friends. Yeah, it's great. I recommend it. It's tough to get into, you know. It's sort of this nebulous world, but I really enjoy it.
So, Ron, let me ask you a question. I mean, who pays for your training, your recurrent in the Gulfstream?
I do.
Aha. Uh-huh. That's not cheap, is it?
No, and you've hit on one of the major barriers to contracting. You have to pay for your own training. And on the Gulfstream, you're talking a five-figure outlay of cash every year, to say nothing of the fact that I got to fly to Dallas, so you got airlines, you've got hotel rooms, you've got food, you've got a rental car, you've got all these ancillary costs. So being a contract pilot, it's a major investment, and that's part of why we make the money that we do, because we have those expenses. So
You're running a small business, and I've known a lot of people that I used to fly with on 135 that said they were just going to go contract because they didn't want to work that hard, and they kind of really didn't understand everything they were getting into. And when they realized they were going to have to pay for their own training, we were flying the Hawkers at the time, and it was quite a shock even then about Recurrent. So I can't even imagine what it costs in a G4.
It's very pricey, and there are other things too that people don't think about. For example, you have to periodically go through Recurrent emergency training, international procedures training, RVSM. There's a lot to it, and it all comes out of the contractor's pocket. So you hit on the key point when you said you're running your own business, and you really have to think of it that way. You have to structure it that way, and you have to have that discipline. And that's not for everyone. It takes a certain mindset, to run a business, and also to have the what I call the charter mindset, which is you're involved in what is essentially a service business. You're providing a service to some pretty discriminating clients, and they depend on a certain level of service in order to, the company does, I mean, to make those clients happy. So
yeah, and that was one of the reasons we didn't used to like to take airline pilots that were furloughed into the 135, because all they wanted to do was fly, and it's much different from that.
It is. Yeah, charter is responsible for loading bags, for helping get the cabin ready. You do your own flight planning. You file your flight plans. You do your own weight and balance. And there can be long delays. Sometimes you're scheduled to leave at 9 a.m. and you don't end up leaving till 3 or 4 p.m. That's one of the benefits of charter. If a client has a delay or something like that, they can show up a few hours later and the plane's going to wait for them. But it definitely takes a different mindset, and not everyone has that. So I've seen some guys make the transition quite successfully from airlines to charter and vice versa, but it's not necessarily for everyone.
Do you have any idea how many pilots do this kind of contract work? I mean, is this a small population, or are there really lots and lots of them?
That's a great question. I don't actually know the answer, Max. I've met quite a few, at Recurrent Training, and there are quite a few at my current company, but...
Is there a trade organization for contract pilots, anything like that?
Not that I'm aware of. There are some companies out there that help connect charter pilot or contract pilots with companies in need of contract labor. But the FAA made a rule change a few years ago that's made that a little bit difficult for 135. Basically, the way it used to work was, if I was typed on a 135 airplane, let's say a Gulfstream 4, and I flew it for Company A, I could go to Company B or C or D and fly any of their 135 flights as well once I had gone through their company-specific training. But now, you could have, like Max, you could have 20,000 hours in a G4. If you didn't go through Recurrent at Company A's on their op spec, you were considered unqualified to fly their airplane in Part 135 service. So it has the effect of tying the contractor and the company together. So I couldn't just go, if I contract for, Acme Air, I couldn't go contract for another company that does charter. I would have to go back to Recurrent on the new company's op spec, even though the training is exactly the same.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Rob, do I understand that you need to drop off soon?
Well, see, unfortunately, I'm not a contract pilot anymore. And I'm riding in row 25 or 26 on this airplane headed back up to Chicago. And they said that if I don't get over there and get on pretty soon, they're going to leave me here. And so I don't want to stay in the terminal in Miami all night.
Is your family with you?
Here. Yeah, they're here. So we've got to get on in just a little bit. So anyway, but listen, and Ron, I'm sorry I have to bug out on you in the middle here before we had our chance to finish chatting, but we don't get that many charter guys on that I can talk lingo with. So this has really been fun. And I'm sorry that I have to run, but for everybody, thank you for joining us and me, and I hope the noise in Miami International wasn't too bad for everybody. And are we going to make a little plug about the Air and Space coming up later on, I think, Max?
Yes, why don't we do that right now really quickly while you're with us.
Hey, a week from Saturday.
God, it's coming up fast.
Get over to the Air and Space Museum, the Udvar-Hazy Pavilion. And I think we open up, what, about 10 or something usually? About,
I think that's right. This is June 14th, Saturday, June 14th.
And then when's the party? Is it that Saturday night or the Friday night? I can't
remember. Saturday night at, say, 7:30 p.m.
At the Green Robin, right?
At Red Robin. Red Robin. You should never forget that.
So I hope a bunch of folks will come out and join us. And hey, listen, Ron, you never know. You might find yourself on a layover there at Dulles.
I was just there. I was just at Dulles a few weeks ago. So you never know. It could happen.
Well, thank you for joining us tonight. And guys, sorry to bug out so soon, but we'll chat over the next few days about what's coming up. And we'll chat soon. So have fun, guys. All right. See you later.
Safe travels.
All right.
Thanks, Rob. Fly safe.
All right. Yeah, we really appreciate Rob to join us from the airport. That can be really difficult to do. Ron, before we go further, maybe you can tell our listeners where they can find you online, where the blog is, and other places where they might follow what you're doing.
Sure. The primary place you'll find my writing is at a website, my own website. I call it the House of Rap, just because it's a playoff of the House of Blues, which is a... Anyway, long story short, it's the website address is www.rap.org. So it's rapp.org. Or you could just Google House of Rap, and or my name, Ron Rap, and it'll come up. It'll be the first link.
That's great.
And I also write for the AOPA Opinion Leaders blog. So I post there once a month. And beyond that, you'll find me on social media, mainly Twitter. So I'll post things on there and Google Plus. I do have a Facebook account, but I post some public things on there. But as far as adding people, I usually just keep it to friends.
What's your handle on Twitter?
It is RonRap1.
Great. One last thing. I know that you've been thinking recently about supersonic jets.
I have, yeah. Actually, that was the most recent article that I wrote. I write for this blogging information group, as we were mentioning. So some of the people you've had on your show, like Brent and Carlene Pettit and people like that, are part of this group. There's about a half dozen people. And we take turns writing on topics. So we would pick a topic like aviation history. And all of us would write on that topic and post within a sequence of days. It got to be a little bit chaotic, especially since we started adding new people. I like the concept. So we're trying something new, which is one of us writes once a month and the others chime in either through their own sites or through commenting on mine. So I picked the topic of a supersonic business jet because I'm real interested in that. I love Gulfstream and I love to see what they've got going on. And they've done actually a lot of research and development, and they've had some supersonic type partnerships, one with Sukhoi, one with NASA. And I can really see them being the ones to actually make the next step. And my basic thesis about this was that I think it's now a potential reality because, you know, if you're going to build something supersonic, it's going to cost $150 million. And 20 years ago, nobody would have paid that for a business jet. I mean, the airliners didn't even cost that. But now we're traveling further. Technology has progressed. And most of all, they've built this Gulfstream 650, these Globals, the Global 5000, 7000, the 8000. And they're selling as fast as they can make them. And these are $70, $75 million airplanes, and people are lined up around the block. So I think if you could get a Mach 1.5, 1.2 airliner, or I'm sorry, 1.5 to 2.0 airliner, I mean, for people whose mission calls for flying 4, 5, 6,000 miles, the amount of time that they would save would be worth it. You know, you figure you put a bunch of executives onto these airplanes. They're making collectively $8, $10 million a year. You figure out what it costs them per hour, and then you look at the inefficiencies of sitting in an airline terminal, you know, waiting in these lines.
Right.
The fact that they can't do business, they can't talk about confidential deals or things like that in a terminal. So they can be much more productive, arrive much more refreshed. And a lot of the charter people that will fly in my business, you know, they're people from Hollywood because we're based in LA, so you have actors, bands, things like that. And those people, they couldn't even do their work without a business jet. I mean, they have to do a concert in Seattle one day and then Miami the next, you know, and they're hopping around all over the country. So I think the market could be there. It's just a question of who's going to build it.
Yeah, a lot of people think that, you know, this is sort of the perk for the wealthy or the the executives, but knowing some of those people and being able to observe what their routine is like and how they work, it doesn't have anything to do with being a perk. It's more about a tool of the trade. And for people in those kinds of positions, it very much is a tool. And so I think I agree with you that there could very well be a good market for that sort of a thing. But like you say, who's gonna step up and do it?
Exactly, especially considering, and this is something that people have pointed out in the comment section, that if a market for such a thing exists, it's going to be a small market. So
sure.
The economics are something that any potential builder is going to have to work out. I mean, it's going to be a gamble. You know, it's a paradigm shifting thing. But I love the idea. I mean, I think it would really put a lot of the excitement back into aviation that's been lacking. I mean, you look at the Concorde and what it did for aviation. So.
All right. Well, Ron, we want to thank you so much for spending the time with us. It's been a great conversation. House of Rapp, RAPP.org. Folks should take a look at that. Check that out. It's great writing, too. I mean, I think as you can tell, you know, Ron knows what he's talking about and is very articulate and does some really high-quality writing. So thank you for that, Ron.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. I'm excited to have had a chance to chat with you guys.
Fantastic. And now here's Pete Combs from the National Business Aviation Association to tell us what to expect in the next NBAA Flight Plan podcast.
Hi, I'm Pete Combs, and if your business is flying, then you'll want to check out NBAA's Flight Plan. Whether you're flight crew, cabin crew, line crew, or maintenance, NBAA's Flight Plan is 5 minutes well spent on topics that range from safety to education to procedures both new and old. You'll find us on Apple's iTunes website or at the home of business aviation, NBAA.org.
Thank you, Pete. And now it's time for the airplane of the week. David, you're on.
Well, thanks, Max. With this week being the 70th anniversary of Operation Overlord, what has become known as D-Day, I thought it would be fitting to do a history segment that combines a British aircraft over French beaches flown by U.S. pilots. The Spitfire. The Spitfire was the hero of the Battle of Britain. It also was a hero in the United States Army Air Corps. From Eagle squadrons that became the 4th Fighter Wing to the sands of North Africa and Italy, the Spitfire played important roles in the initial stand-up of our air presence in Europe. But why am I bringing this up about D-Day? Believe it or not, the U.S. Navy flew Spits on the days leading up to and beyond that decisive June 4th day. Yes, you don't need to rewind the show. I said U.S. Navy. When committing to an amphibious assault, you first need to soften the beachhead. For Operation Overlord, that was accomplished by the USS Arkansas, USS Nevada, USS Texas battleships for the United States, and the HMS Warsprite, HMS Ramillies, and HMS Rodney, one of my all-time favorite ships, as well as her sister, the Nelson. The U.S. ships used Curtiss SOC-1B Seagull biplanes from cruisers and Voight OS-2U Kingfishers from the battleships. Each ship had either two or three aircraft and as many as two aviators per aircraft and the additional enlisted spotting crew. The float planes would be catapulted off the ship and scout for beyond-the-horizon targets for the big guns. However, they were slow, and it was clear from early planning that for them to provide targeting, they would be too slow and extremely vulnerable. Anti-aircraft artillery in the Luftwaffe would have a field day with the biplanes and the Kingfishers. Ironically, the Luftwaffe put up four SKG-10 FW-190s, and KG-54 did several strafing runs, and of course the legendary strafing run down Sword Beach of Joseph Pripps Piller and his wingman, Heinz Wodarek, made famous in The Longest Day, was the sum total of the first day's defense by the Luftwaffe. Hardly intimidating. On April of 1944, 17 VO crews, Navy observation crews from the battleships and cruisers, flew their aircraft to Ipswich, where they were placed in storage. The crews stood up as VCS-7, composite squadron under the command of Lieutenant Commander William Denton, Jr. The crews were sent to Middle Wallop to be trained by U.S. Army Air Force 15th Tactical Recon Squadron. All 17 pilots were then trained on the Spitfire Mark V. It was a learning curve, considering the top speed of the OS-2U Kingfisher was 164 miles an hour, and the Spitfire's cruising speed was 262 miles per hour. By 8 May 1944, the squadron was transferred from Mittawalap. Of note, I was at Mittawalap at the Army Museum of Flying and saw my first Prukhara there in 86, one of those great museums in England, to Royal Naval Air Station Leon Solent. VCS-7 then reported to the 3rd Naval Fighter Wing of the Fleet Air Arm. The wing consisted of 5 RAF and 4 FAA squadrons and the Yanks. The workload was divided between the Western and Eastern Naval Task Forces. The Western would be responsible for the U.S. beaches, then codenamed Utah and Omaha. The Eastern would be the British beaches of Gold, Juno, and Sword. The aircraft then formed a pool for D-Day. The makeup of the pool was 2 squadrons of RAF Spit 5s, 3 squadrons of Mustang Mark 1 and Mark 1As, and 4 FAA squadrons of Seafire Mark 3s, the naval version adaptation of the Spitfire Mark 2C. That left the Yanks to borrow the leftovers. Since they weren't qualified in the Mustangs, they were out. Taking off before dawn on June 6, 1944, VCS 7, the pilots flew in pairs over the beaches of Omaha and Utah, one spotting for the bombardment ships, the other watching his lead 6. The weather of the day caused these brave men to fly at levels less than 2,000 feet for their 2-hour sorties. 4 VCS-7 flights were attacked by the Luftwaffe. They suffered no losses. Lieutenant Richard M. Barclay was shot down by flak. He eventually made his way back to the squadron, and after several days, his wingman also suffered flak damage, but was able to return to base. During the next 3 days, VCS-7 flew 94 sorties. By June 10th, the squadron was released to also strafe the beachheads as forward support in addition to their gunnery spotting. The sortie rate declined after the 11th. The maximum number of sorties flown at any time was 17 by one pilot. On June 26th, the bombardment of Cherbourg concluded. At that point, the battles had moved beyond the range of the battleships and cruisers. VCS-7 disbanded on 27 June 1944. The naval aviators gathered their aircraft and flew back to their battle wagons. Most of the aviators went on to participate in Operation Dragoon on 15 August, the invasion of southern France. During VCS's 20 days of combat operations, its pilots were awarded 9 Distinguished Flying Crosses, 6 Air Medals, and 5 Gold Stars. Not bad for a unit of 17 aviators who saw combat for 20 days and flew a total of 191 sorties. Now it's time for the historian to get on his soapbox. On June 3rd, an order was issued that all aircraft, with the exceptions of heavy bombers from the 8th Air Force and RAF Bomber Command, were to have 5 alternating stripes, 3 white, 2 black. On single-engine fighters, the stripes were to be 18 inches wide, placed 6 inches inboard of the roundel on the wing, and 18 inches forward the leading edge of the tailplane. No national insignias or serials were to be obscured. Twin engine aircraft stripes were 24 inches wide and 2 feet outboard the engines. Again, the fuselage stripes were to be 18 inches forward the tailplane. The order was given to the transport and glider squadrons on June 3rd, the rest of the aircraft units on June 4th. The invasion was originally scheduled for June 5th. That means over 1,200 aircraft needed those stripes. There's no way in hell they were masked off. They used mops or whatever to get those stripes on those planes in temporary paint. However, modelers and museums, warbird owners, have contributed to the myth of perfect stripes on aircraft. It didn't happen. There wasn't time and they weren't pretty. And they were all gone off of upper services by July and completely off the aircrafts by the end of 1944. So there you have it, a historian's pet peeve about people who spend hours masking stripes. It didn't happen. At some point, we're going to discuss staining coming out of the hot air vents on the wings of B-17s. But for now, this is your airplane geek historian, David Vanderhoof, signing off.
Well, that's fascinating. Yeah, I mean, you always see perfect stripes, don't you?
Yeah, it pisses me off. It's just one of those nagging things that, you know, just somebody bake a warbird and throw some stripes on it. And because it didn't happen. Yeah. There were some that got masked off, but the majority of them, it was a temporary camouflage thing so that they wouldn't get shot at. So
interesting. Ron,
the stripes were kind of... Oh, I was going to say the stripes were kind of like the rest of the airplane, right? Like all the pictures I see of World War II aircraft in theater, you know, the aircraft were pretty beat up and kind of fit the total image of the aircraft. Whereas today, you see a warbird, it's polished and clean and, you know,
it's pretty perfect.
Much spotless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ron, I was going to ask you, what warbirds have you flown?
I've flown a bunch of different things. I mean, that's not really my major deal, but everything from Stearman's to the T-6 to the... BT-13 to some liaison aircraft to let's say PT-22, just a lot of little things like that. So kind of to the point where like the next thing would be a Mustang, but I don't see that happening.
Sure.
You know, unless I meet the right person.
There's twin stick Mustangs out there. So
there are, in fact, at my last company, I flew with another contract pilot who owned two of them, two Mustangs. I mean, and one of them was a two-stick airplane.
How do you know there were two-stick Mustangs? Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
All right, now it's time for Rob's Aviation Minute. Rob, of course, has left us for this episode, but he leaves behind his Aviation Minute. So here's Rob.
From Chicago, I'm Rob Mark, and this is the Aviation Minute. Memorial Day in the United States is a time each year when we recognize the men and the women who served and perished in military conflicts since our Civil War here in the 1800s. Being a vet myself, let me say thanks to the members of the U.S. Air Force, the Marines, the Army, the Navy, and the Coast Guard for serving our country. This Memorial Day, though, there are many stories out there related to the mistreatment of vets. You know, those people we say we care so much about with those stupid support our troops bumper stickers, which are actually pretty insulting to vets if you want to know the truth. And that's because actions speak louder than words. About a month ago, the White House's latest scandal, of which the president says he knew nothing, uncovered long lines for veterans to use the VA healthcare system they're entitled to. Some waited too long and died before they were ever seen. After spending 5 years in the Air Force as an air traffic controller during the Vietnam era, I came home to the same vet indifference that many of the other people of my era did as President Nixon began to wind down that war. But at least I was all in one piece, with no battle wounds or post-traumatic signs of stress. And that was a long time ago, too. Today, our volunteer military vets are busted up, both physically and mentally, from multiple tours of duty in the Middle East. Some are so bad that these days, about 2 vets take their own lives each day. So the number of veteran casualties the media is reporting is probably much greater than any of us realize. Let me say that again. The current suicide rate among veterans is a catastrophic 2 per day. Not per month, 2 people each day of each week of each month. And it's been like that for years. President Obama's statement that he knew nothing about the VA problems, of course, says as much about him as a leader as about the secretary of the VA he chose. For what it's worth, the VA was also a problem when George W. Bush was president. Presidents all seem to talk a good game, but 2 dead soldiers a day should be enraging those bumper sticker lovers. But it's not. This leadership vacuum has parallels in the aviation industry, too, where for at least a decade or more, the top transportation jobs at DOT and FAA have often been handed out to people that are friends of the president. Neither our DOT secretary nor our FAA administrator had any industry experience before they showed up for work. So is it any surprise that these 2 accomplished little more than regularly scripted PR dog and pony shows about transportation? Or is it any surprise at all that the DOT and the FAA jobs tend to go to people near the bottom of the POTUS's I owe you list? Seriously, the Prez is saying, how much damage can a DOT or an FAA leader really do to the transportation industry? Now, just in time for Memorial Day came news last week that United Airlines had been slapped on the wrist by a U.S. district judge in Colorado to hand over more than $6 million in back pension contributions to nearly 1,200 United pilots. These pilots took official leaves of absence to serve in various branches of the military between 2000 and 2010. United didn't agree to pay those vets what the company owed them voluntarily, though. Those 1,200 pilots filed a claim against the federal government. And, of course, they continually pestered United Airlines. Somehow, I guess United must have just forgotten to support its own troops. Back in Washington, though, I wondered about all those vets dying every day because the president didn't know anything about it. And now, he says he's outraged. Although, with Mr. Obama, I have no idea how you can tell. So I wonder what the plan is now. Maybe fire the secretary of the VA? Please, Mr. Obama, no more dog and pony shows. You'll only put someone else in the job with the same indifferent attitude. Or wait, am I getting the VA confused with the DOT? No, I don't think so. So this year, listeners, let's try something different. Save your money on bumper stickers and write the White House and the Congress. Tell them you're tired of the president acting like two service people dying each day is just a paperwork problem. Because it's not. Not even close. From Chicago, I'm Rob Mark. See you next time.
All right. Strong message from Rob.
Boy, what a sad statistic.
Absolutely, yeah. And I understand the Veterans Affairs Secretary, Eric Shinseki, or Shinseki?
Shinseki.
Shinseki has in fact, resigned.
Yeah, I hope things will change, boy, because that's just such a terrible way to repay the people who have fought so hard for us overseas.
I know.
In what's really been our longest war.
It's tragic. It really is. Okay, now we have Peter Johnson's Across the Pond, and we've had several references and some listeners talk about, gee, how about aviation in Africa? And so Peter stepped up, and here's Peter's Across the Pond for this episode.
Today, we go back to North Africa and the Middle East, and we welcome back Osama Sala from the Osama's Tape blog. Osama, welcome back Across the Pond.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Thank you for joining us again. It's a very popular segment when we get to talk about some of the careers we do. I think it's a dynamic part of the world and everyone's really interested. But we did have some feedback recently to talk a little bit more about North Africa. We know that there hasn't been a great deal going on, but things are shifting a little bit. There's been some increases in some flights and new routes and things like that. North Africa, is it turning a corner?
Well, as the political situation stabilizes in Egypt, Tunis, and to a certain extent in Algeria and Morocco, things are kind of improving. Tourism, yeah, optimistically, should be better this summer. However, as you said, things are on the whole improving. I mean, in Egypt, Egyptair and Egyptair Express are actually starting to operate flights from directly to their Red Sea resorts like Gardaqa and, you know, to attract Kuwaitis and Saudis to come directly there without having to go to Cairo and come back. I think as Europe improves, the economic situation there starts improving, we will probably see more charter flights going into these resorts.
Yeah.
To bring up the tourist numbers. Now, Tunis has been probably the first Arab Spring, and it seems to be the first Arab Spring country that is actually stabilizing. And we've seen a new hybrid airline called CFAX, which is based in Safakos in Tunisia.
Okay.
In Safakos, that's a city in Tunis on the eastern side. And it started operations in April 2012. Currently, they're operating two A319s and three A320s. And they actually reported a small after-tax loss in 2012, but they think they will be turning the corner financially in 2013 and 2014. They actually have one leased A330, which they're flying to Montreal.
Okay.
Because they think they figured there's about 16,000 Tunisians who live in Canada. And with the A330, they're looking at places like Beijing to attract Chinese tourists. And they're discussing with the FAA to commence flights to New York in 2015.
Okay, gosh, that is a shift, isn't it?
Yes, and of course, Tunis Air has aircraft on order. We have three A330s on order and five A320s.
Yeah.
Which actually signals an optimistic view of how tourism will develop in the coming few years. Now, Air Algérie has 787s, 8787s on order, which cannot, I'm not sure it's reported somewhere, but it's not probably very official unless it's going to be leased aircraft. They have five 737-800 NGs and they have three A330-200s on order. So that also shows their optimism about attracting tourists to Algeria.
Yeah. Now, Air Algérie has always been one of those carriers that seems to have performed reasonably well. I remember it decades ago flying in and out of London, always regular, always on time. It seems to be one of the better performers there.
Well, you have to remember that North Africa has a lot of migrant workers in Europe.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of ethnic North Africans living who are actually holding EU passports.
Yeah.
And their problem started in 2008 with the financial bubble. And, because people stopped, they relied a lot on ethnic travel of people living in Europe coming to visit their friends and families in North Africa. That slowed down when the economy is tanked out. Now that the economy is coming back, things are improving. So they're optimistic. Same thing with Royal Air Maroc. They have 4787 on order, 5 737-800s on order, and they actually are looking for increased tourism. But Morocco has always been a very popular tourist destination for Europeans.
Yeah, I think my son's going there in October to climb a mountain. Certainly from a personal sense, it hadn't been on my radar for a while. But it seems that more people are going there.
As I said, as Europe's economic situation improves, they will probably be seeing more and more tourists coming in.
In terms of some of the more troubled areas, I know we've talked before about Libya, and of course it's having some challenges at the moment. Is there any sign that airline traffic will improve there, or is it still too troubled to see any light at the end of the tunnel?
As long as the political and security situation in Libya is turbulent, to say the least,
yeah,
I don't think we are going to see a lot of traffic. I mean, it's a rich country. There's lots of oil. It is potentially a good tourist destination that requires a lot of development.
Yeah.
Certainly, Libyan Arab Airlines have something like 10 A350s on order. Other Afriqiya has a few airplanes on order. There are a couple of startups that are coming up. However, with the military with the security situation and the lack of political stability and political leadership in the country, I mean, we're seeing existing carriers that operate to Tripoli and Benghazi are actually, one day they operate, the next week they're suspending flights for a couple of weeks, then they go back. So it's been like erratic and intermittent. And unless things stabilize and some kind of normalcy is seen, I don't think we are going to see much in the coming few months, probably years. However, they have the potential to be a big player.
Okay, well, let's leave North Africa there. That was all we had time for with Osama on North Africa. But we continued the conversation and we'll bring that to you next week when we get to talk around the Middle East.
This is Peter Johnson reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
All right, thanks, Peter. It's always great to hear from Osama and get his perspective on that region. So we look forward to the next part next week. Okay, moving on to listener feedback. Let's start off with just a brief recording. As you all know, we love listener recordings, things that you send us that describe your aviation experiences, maybe that first flight or a memorable aviator that you met or something like that. And we heard from Marcus. Now, Marcus is the guy behind the Omega Tau podcast, which we've mentioned a couple times in the past. Excellent podcast. And he sent us a recording about his first air show. So here's Marcus.
Hello, my name is Marcus. I'm calling or sending this MP3 from Germany. So I want to tell you about my first air show experience. When I was 14, I just started gliding in Germany. I was spending essentially every weekend on the airfield. And I think the first day I took off on weekends from gliding was on August 28, 1988. If you remember, this was the last Air Force air show in Germany, in Ramstein. My father, my brother, and myself, we drove there with with my father's old 200D Daimler diesel car. It took us forever. And it was a great air show. A lot of solo displays, F-15s, F-16s, a lot of interesting static stuff. Really cool. And then, of course, at the end, there was the demo by the Italian Frecce Tricolori team, which you probably all know had this fatal crash where I think 70 or 100 people died. We were at the very front of the crowd, and it was funny. Well, it wasn't funny, but it was strange when we saw the crash. Initially, I thought it was actually part of the airshow display. I didn't realize, and then I saw the thing crashing down. It became hot. Actually, I wasn't hit. Obviously, I wasn't hurt, but I felt the heat, and I turned around and ran away. And I remember jumping over people lying on the ground. It was really not so nice. And then it took me, of course, a little while until I met up with my father and my brother again. My mother wasn't with us, and she, of course, heard in the news that this catastrophe happened, and she, of course, essentially panicked. And, of course, there weren't any mobile phones at the time, 1988, right? We had to find telephone booth. Of course, all of them were busy, but at some point we found one and called her and told her that everything was all right, or is all right. So it was really impressive in many ways. The air show was really great, and I always said that I was happy that the Frecce Tricolori display, which went so badly wrong, was actually the last display. So, because I'm sure everything else would have been cancelled if it had happened earlier. In any case, this was the last air show in Germany. I thought that's unfortunate. I would have gone to other air shows. After all, people go there voluntarily. And I'm not sure if it's the government's task to prevent things like that. I mean, not the accident, the whole air show. Yeah, that was my little air show story. I have to use this opportunity also for a little shameless plug. I'm also a podcaster, hence the nice sound from my microphone. I run the Omega Tau podcast, the science podcast, which also covers a lot of aviation topics, obviously, since I'm an aviation geek. So you may want to check it out, omegataupodcast.net. Thanks. Ciao.
All right. Thanks, Marcus. Boy, what an experience, huh?
Yeah, that's one of the biggest catastrophic failures at an air show ever. I didn't realize that Germany continued to ban air shows after that.
Yeah.
Definitely a unique first. Wow.
Now, almost coincidentally, well, actually totally coincidentally, we got an email from Andy, who congratulated us on reaching 300 episodes. But he also noted a recent episode, episode 148, actually, of the Omega Tau podcast. And he says it's a two-hour interview with two ex-military pilots who operate the only civilian Sea Harrier jump jet, which they display at air shows. So thanks to Andy for passing that on. Yeah, the Omega Tau podcast, again, omegataupodcast.net, is kind of a science show, but they do have a fair amount of aviation, or Marcus does have a lot of aviation items in there. And so that's definitely worth checking out. And thanks to Andy for making us aware of this episode 148.
Well, I'll tell you, with with two guys operating a Sea Harrier in the civilian world. I'm surprised they were able to keep it to 2 hours. I would have been chatting with them all night, you know.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, that's quite a unique opportunity to get some insight into the Sea Harrier.
We need to get you down here, Max, so you can see it when it does Atlantic City.
Oh, that would be very cool. Yeah, I would like to see that. Most of my jump jet, the Harrier experience, comes from that Arnold Schwarzenegger movie.
Which is kind of cool.
Which is kind of
like,
cool.
I've always liked that movie, especially the fact that they actually got to blow up the bridge.
They actually blew up the bridge?
What's the movie we're talking about? True Lies.
True Lies.
The bridge in the Keys.
Yes.
They actually were able to take that out with some rockets. That's actually live footage. They had to blow that up. They got permission since it was a defunct bridge. They blew it up.
I didn't know that. I've driven right past that.
True Lies is a really good, fun movie. I know that I recommend it for all airplane geeks. Yes, he's floating around the nose on a Harrier being flown by his daughter. But you know what? Overall, that's the tone of the movie. So,
boy, that must have been a real critical take. You know, what happens if you mess it up? It's not like you can put the bridge back together.
That's right. You do it in one take, and it's got to be right.
Yeah.
Maybe the people that did that should go work for Airbus and Boeing.
No, they're Marines. That's what they're supposed to do, blow things up and blow things up effectively.
That's right. Okay, let's move on. I hope we can get to all this. If not, we're going to have links to all the items that we intend to talk about in the show notes. But we did hear from Jamie Dodson. We've heard from Jamie, of course, a number of times. He's been on the show. NickGrantAdventures.com. But he's sent us two articles from phys.org, phys.org. Aircraft wings that change their shape in flight can help protect the environment. And the other article is using thoughts to control airplanes. So, these are pretty good articles. Very interesting, sort of techie sorts of stuff. On the shape morphing of aircraft wings, we have control surfaces and slats and flaps and things like that. But that doesn't mean that through all phases of flight, the shape of the wing is optimized. And so some folks are working on that problem. That's pretty interesting. And the other one on thought control, there's actually a wired up pilot who thinks without touching the flight controls, and the plane responds. This is something that's being done at the Institute for Flight System Dynamics, the university in Munich. And so we'll put those links in the show notes for the interesting techie stuff. We heard from Anurag. He writes that he's an Indian living in South Korea. We've heard from him almost 2 years ago, he said, and he sent us some links back then. He can also congratulate us on the 300th episode. He remembers starting listening from episode 127. Says, you guys have come a long way. Yes, we have. But every episode seems fresh in content and excitement. Thank you for that. He asks, I want to know if you guys lurk around on Reddit. That's R-E-D-D-I-T. He says, there's a big aviation community on Reddit where people share aviation news, pictures, funny stuff, and so forth. And that's at reddit.com/r/aviation. We'll put that link in the show notes. I know of Reddit. I've never done anything with Reddit. David or Ron, have you had any experience with Reddit?
A little bit, yeah. I actually got introduced to it. I mean, I knew about it, but I didn't really do much on it until Brent Owens turned me on to it. And so there's actually two. There's a reddit.com/r/aviation, aviation board, and there's another one, which is /r/flying, which is the one that I'm on more often. But
you know, it's hard. There's so many communities. You can be on Facebook, you can be on Google Plus, you can be on Reddit, you can just generally be on Twitter and create a community there.
Oh yeah, you could.
It's hard.
Dig and Tumblr it's impossible to keep up with them all. It really is.
Yeah, it's kind of a challenge for us, for airplane geeks. David, you're more on our Facebook side.
Well, yeah. I mean, I keep up with the Facebook page. But, I mean, I guess our primary listeners are on Twitter. we have communities everywhere. Facebook does have an active community where people chime in and get into conversations. Twitter, it's tough. We can only be so many places at one time, and Rob's usually stuck at an airport somewhere. So yeah, it's so just he's Max nowhere. And I.
All right. Ryan sent us a picture of his, the desk where he builds models. And that's where he listens to us generally. Also listens to Plane Crazy Down Under and Aviation Extended. But he sent a photo of his modeling desk. Maybe we'll put this in the show notes. Does this look like where you build models, David?
Yeah, it looks like a bench.
Looks like a bench with a lot of stuff.
They tend to look like that, and you usually have a one-foot square area to actually work on the model. The rest of it's clutter, and no matter how often you clean it, it reverts back to that one-foot square.
Ron, were you ever a model airplane builder?
You know, I never was. I love them, and I have tremendous appreciation for some of the incredible things people do with the models, but I never really had a talent for working with something that small.
Yeah, I dabbled when I was much younger. Nothing as serious as David here does, that's for sure. And as far as I know, there are no remaining examples of any models that I put together in the past, unless my mother has something stashed away in some place that she hasn't told me about.
Yeah, mine either, and I think that's probably a good thing.
I think so, yes.
Yeah.
We heard from Aaron. He said he's been a listener of this show for over 2 years now. He says he loves the podcast. Recently, he came across an article. All right, this was in Medium. Medium.com is a site that has articles written by a wide variety of people on a lot of different topics, and they strive for high-quality articles is, I guess, one way to characterize them. So this particular article is titled, 2 weeks ago, I almost died in the deadliest plane crash ever. And this is a story told by a passenger on a commercial flight that had a near miss. I guess TCAS went off. I think TCAS went off, if I'm remembering this correctly. You guys help me if I've got it wrong. And the pilot of the plane that the author was on went into a dive in order to maintain some separation. And so he writes this rather dramatic article. And it's getting a lot of attention. Captain Jeff over at the Airline Pilot Guy podcast, he addressed this in his episode 118. That's worth listening. The author makes it sound maybe a bit more dramatic than it really was. What do you think?
I haven't read the article, so I'm kind of looking at it as we go here. But I agree with some of the things that the author says. For example, the way technology can become a crutch for pilots. Over-reliance on autopilots, lack of time hand flying, and things like that. But that wouldn't have anything to do with a near midair with another airplane, I don't think. So I don't know. It's kind of difficult to say exactly what went on there. You know, I don't think we're getting the entire story.
Yeah, it kind of has that feel to it. And we'll put a link to the Airline Pilot Guy episode where Captain Jeff describes or sort of evaluates the facts as they're described in the article, and also bringing in his knowledge and experience as an airline captain.
Yeah, they do go in. I'm reading a portion of it here where the author says near misses are terrifyingly common in high traffic areas. I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. I mean, I fly in one of the busiest areas in the world, the Los Angeles Basin, and especially when you're flying IFR. I mean, I haven't had a terrifying number of near misses at all. And I used to do some flying. I used to fly for a company that drops sterilized med flies, and we'd fly underneath the LAX localizer. I mean, we were looking up at helicopters at times with these King Airs. We were way down there. And, I mean, even mixing it up like we did there, I wouldn't consider those near misses.
Yeah.
So.
All right. So, we'll have the article, link to the article in the show notes, and you can take a look at that. Listen to Captain Jeff. If you don't listen to the Airline Pilot Guy already, and you're interested in commercial aviation, highly recommend that show. Jeff's been on this on the podcast as our guest too.
But Jeff's really cool because the quality of his show, considering he records out of hotel rooms, is always phenomenal. So I definitely one to listen to. Even I listen to that one, and I don't really care about airliners.
Yeah.
So.
Jeff is the kind of he's the kind of guy that I want to have, you know, behind the stick of the airplane I'm riding
behind the
back
yoke.
Yeah, behind the yoke. Sorry. Okay, we heard from Jody Bromer. Remember, Jody was a guest previously. She's a helicopter pilot. And she said that while she doesn't want us to perceive her as using this show as a job board.
If you're interested in being a helicopter mechanic out west, send an email to us and we'll forward it over to Jody.
Yeah, there's an opening there as an AMP mechanic or even an avionics tech at their helicopter flight school. This is in Utah. And they're looking for qualified mechanics. And they're having some difficulty doing that, which is interesting because, you know, we talk about aviation careers from time to time and, you know, the availability of positions and so forth. And mechanics, tech guys like that are sometimes in high demand. And we've even seen some cases where some of the airlines are starting to hire again. So the prospects, I think, are kind of looking up. Ron, do you sort of get that sense that, you know, maybe with the economy improving and the situation changing, that careers in aviation may be starting to look a little bit brighter than they have over the last few years? Any thoughts?
I think it kind of depends on which segment of the aviation ecosystem you're looking at. When it comes to the airlines, and again, I'm biased because I'm not in the airline industry, but I still don't think it looks very good, especially when you're talking about the regionals, because a lot of the systemic issues that are causing these problems are still there. I mean, the wages are still stagnated. You still have the perpetual conflicts between the unions and management and things like that. But I think there are a lot of other areas, and I think the A&P field is one of them where, honestly, if I could go back and do it again, I would definitely get my A&P.
Yeah, you have some interest in that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if nothing else, I would have saved enough money to buy several cars just on maintenance I've done on my own aircraft.
Huh.
I can't tell you how many times I've been somewhere in some airplane and I've got some issue with the plane, and I just wish I had that extra level of knowledge, you know?
Sure.
And I know a lot of people who are professional pilots, and having that A&P on your resume, I think that's a fantastic boost on the resume. It really says a lot.
Sure.
So,
very good.
To say nothing of the fact that they're good paying jobs, you don't have to spend your life living out of hotels. I mean, there's a lot to be said for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. We heard from Juan. He sent us an email. Says, well, he's been a long time listener. Thank you for that, Juan. He says, I agree with David that the best IFE system is the window. He says, as a pilot and operator of airborne remote sensing equipment, he says, I enjoy my time looking out of the window. Last Sunday, after an airborne mapping project in Mexico, I had to fly on a local carrier, which was Interjet. And he flew on a Sukhoi Superjet 100. And he says, I was impressed that on the IFE screens, they show the view from a belly camera during takeoff and landings. In this case, it was so amazing that I stopped looking out the window to look at the IFE screen. Our approach to Mexico City was under IMC. I made a video of the IFE display and uploaded to YouTube. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. And, you know, I've said before, I like airplane mounted cameras on commercial planes. But I got to tell you, this belly camera view, this is the view that I really want to see, especially for takeoff and landing. So we'll put that in the show notes. It's a great view. I like this a lot.
You just want to see if the landing gear is down and locked.
Yeah, it makes you feel better. And, you know, is the runway, you know, sort of, you know, are we kind of lined up well, or is the pilot way off to the side or whatever. So,
and God forbid something, he's offline or the landing gear is down and locked. Do you really want to know that?
Yeah.
Plus, I think about it, it helps passengers in their decision making. Are they going to compliment the pilot on the way out? What kind of criticism or suggestions will they offer, right?
Right. It's the perfect view to do that.
There was someone who was looking at building airliners. Maybe it was Ariane, one of these supersonic jet companies, but looking at building airliners with no windows in them.
Mm.
Just having.
Yeah, we saw that with the digital screens on the walls.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, with one little screen and a seat back, you can see the effect it has. So I can totally see that happening.
Yeah, for sure. All right, just really
on.
What's that?
I said you won't get me on it.
Oh, yeah, I know. It just takes it's not the same. All right, really quickly to finish up, we heard from Robbie, who sent along a link from motoring.com, Honda Jet's first milestone. The Honda Jet is moving along. This is the HA420 small jet, VLJ, very light jet. Do we even say very light jet anymore? I'm not sure if we do.
I think that's still a term out there.
And yeah, Honda's been working on this for a long time. You want to talk about long gestation periods. But then on the other hand, you know what? That sounds totally like Honda. You know, get it right, slowly make progress, incrementally, bit by bit, get it right. And when it comes out, it's successful. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Thanks to Robbie for that. And then finally from Rob, again, this is a different Rob, not our Rob. There was a case where a service dog on an airliner had to relieve himself in the cabin. And
not once, but twice.
That's right. And they tried to clean it up, but didn't work out too well. And it was just so bad that...
How bad was it?
They had to make an emergency landing to get the plane down and the people out. And, of course, the owner of the dog, the woman who owned the dog, I guess was, well, in the articles, they say that she was very apologetic. Probably she was kind of mortified at this. But I guess I understand that some kind of a ground delay, maybe a two-hour ground delay on the front end of the flight sort of added to the time that the dog would have had to hold it. So I don't think anyone is really criticizing her or faulting the dog, but that's a flight they'll remember forever.
I wonder how long that flight was. I've done quite a few dogs, you know, in the charter business. They'll come along, you know, with the passengers, and yeah. I've been shocked at how well they're behaved. I mean, they lay down and they just, for 6, 7, 8, 9 hour flights, they'll just sit there.
Yeah, oh, it's amazing. Yeah, it
yeah.
is. Okay, time to close it out. I want to thank you all for listening to this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, Ron Rapp, the House of Rapp. Ron, once again, tell our listeners where they can find you.
You can find me on the web at www.rapp.org, RAPP.org.
Thank you very much. We also want to thank our contributor this time, Peter Johnson from Aviation Extended podcast. Find him at aviation-extended.co.uk. If you're observant, we didn't have an Australia desk report this week. So hopefully Stephen Grant will come back to us again next episode. All right, let's tell folks where they can find us online. David, where can people find more of you?
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Google+. And, of course, you can find me on Friday mornings with Max Flight on the UAV Digest podcast.
Very good. And we'll sub for Rob Mark. You can find him at jetwine.com. Just look for Jetwine on Twitter.
Type Jetwine in Google. You'll have all the hits.
All the hits. So we'll look forward to Rob for the whole episode next time. And I'm Max Flight. You can look for me on Twitter and Google+ is Max Flight. Also the UAV Digest, as David mentioned. And at the PAXX podcast, the Passenger Experience podcast that I co-host with Mary Kirby at runwaygirlnetwork.com. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Full show notes for this episode are at airplanegeeks.com/301 for episode 301. Be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+. And we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream us to your mobile phone, and also on TuneIn.com. If you want to send us an email, that address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we have a listener line where you can leave us a brief audio message. I hope it's still working. We haven't had any audio messages recently, but here's Aunt Benet.
The Airplane Geeks want to hear from you, so please give them a call at 361-GEEKS-01.
Now, Benet will be joining us for the Become a Pilot Day at the National Air and Space Museum on June 14th. So even if you don't care about me or David or Rob and you want to meet Benet Wilson, be sure to stop by and find us. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
If you're observant, we didn't have an Australia desk report this week. Hopefully, Steve
and Grant Wow.
That was a serious senior moment.
One episode, you forgot who they were. Wow.
Oh, my gosh. So hopefully Steve and Grant will come back to us again next episode.
Probably not after that.
Maybe not.